This is an ABC podcast.
My guest on Conversations today is Jeff Green. There was a time when Jeff just dreamt of Australia. Growing up in a council estate in the deepest, northest, westest of England, Australia was a faraway paradise of kangaroos and sunshine. As fate would have it, Jeff ended up living in Australia, which meant that paradise got somewhat less rosy, while England became the place he dreamt about. All this emotional to-ing and fro-ing is the basis of his new comedy show called Letters Home. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Tell me about the conversation you're having with your mum this morning. What's she been up to?
Oh, my mother, she was in Nantwich, which is just a little village near Chester, which is where I'm from, in the northwest of England. She'd just been dancing.
What sort of dancing does your mum get up to?
Well, she's 78, nearly 79. So I'm probably assuming it's not hip hop. And
only assuming.
Break dancing, yeah, but it could be. You never know what passes. I think it'll be ballroom dancing. And she loved it. And she saw a group. And not a band, she saw a group, and they were great. And she wished me luck to come on the show.
So she's a fairly sparky character, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very lucky that my mother, despite, you know, approaching 80, doesn't seem to be showing any signs of slowing down. And my stepfather as well, who's a little younger than her. She took a bit of a toy boy, I think.
Cougar.
Yes, totally cougar. He's very supportive and always has been. I was very lucky for my mum to meet my stepfather.
What did your mum look like when you were growing up, Jeff?
There's pictures of my mum, very beautiful, lovely eyes, and a bit of a dolly bird, and was certainly a catch. You know, she was married three times before she reached her 30s, so, you know, she...
That's a busy 20s, three times.
It is a busy
20s.
Well, that's what happened in those days. I want to say those days, in the 50s and 60s. My mother was married at 16 and had my sister at 18. She had three kids at 24. That was just how it was. And a lot of the reason for that was that she wanted to escape home. You know, often I think nowadays, home is just far too comfortable for children. I've got a friend, Denise Scott, that says, if you ever want your kids to leave home, don't buy them a double bed. She says, once they've got a double bed, they ain't going.
They'll go get married instead.
Yeah, well, and bring someone else home, yeah. But in the 50s and 60s, when home was a two up, two down, which is what we used to call those places, and an outside toilet and a coal fire, you know, most people that were in grinding poverty, and also and an enamel... bucket for the loo in the middle of the night, which I used to use when I stayed at my grandmother's, and I terrify my children about it these days. But if you when you're surrounded by that, you know, you dream of getting out, and I think that's what women did. They wanted to get out.
So where do you come in the lineup of husbands then, Jeff? Whose offspring are you?
I'm my mother's second husband. A little bit of confusion. I've actually had three surnames. I had three surnames before I was even left school. Green is my third surname. I was born Geoffrey Nielsen. That was my mum's first husband. I acquired his name for some reason. I've never really asked my mum why, but I'm sure there's some sort of hiccup of dates going on, and, you know, you don't pry so far into the future, into the past. But then I was Geoffrey Thomas, and then by the time I was 16, I was Geoffrey Green. Kids at school thought I was on a witness protection programme. I kept changing my name.
Were you self-conscious about it at school? I mean, how unusual was your
three
sort of
was
family?
Unusual. Two was normal. Most people, not true, most people, but I knew quite a few people that came, that went home from the school holidays known as Jones and came back as Keegan. It was just normal what boys and girls did when their mothers took new husbands.
And what about for you personally, when these switches happened, was it confusing or just this is what's happening?
It was just what was happening. Yeah, I was had two sisters. They've got a different name to me, and I've got two half sisters, two half brothers. And then I've got two stepsisters. I'm an only child in a family of seven.
And how do you all get on?
I get on great with all of them because I am the sort of the fulcrum to them. I've got something in common with everybody.
In a Venn diagram of your family, you sit right at that lodestar.
Yeah, exactly. I could never draw a family tree when I was growing up. All kids grew family trees and I drew them, and I was like, I can't seem to get this bit of the family over to that bit of the family. It looked like I'd been struck by lightning several times. People used to say, well, are you from a broken home? I go, no, more of a derelict bomb site, to be honest.
What kind of house did you and your mum live in when you were a kid. What was this council estate like?
So our council estate was a place called Blaken in Chester. And Chester's very twee. Chester is 2,000 years old. It was founded by the Romans. It used to be called Devo. It was the 20th Legion's main base for keeping the Welsh in check. That was the whole point of it. It was a place to cross the River Dee. And you can't, in fact, you can't go anywhere in Chester. You can't build a car park without digging up some kind of Roman villa. But then on the outskirts of that was a place called Blaken, which was built in the 50s. At the time, it was the largest council estate in Western Europe.
Holy moly!
Yeah, it was big, but it wasn't rough. I mean, we were told you live in Blaken, that's rough. But I mean, it was rough for Chester. It wasn't rough for the north. It wasn't Manchester rough, where you've got to run to your car, and or East London rough. It was probably Australia rough. Right, where, people, if they don't sell Oldman milk in the cafe, that's considered rough.
Was it a high rise, though? I mean, what did it look like?
No, we had a... it was a mixture of council houses and private dwellings. And we had a council house, which we bought from the council for £2,000. And I lived there until I was 10. And then my mum and dad divorced. And I moved into a flat, a council flat above a butcher's. And we were sort of terrorised by these dogs that used to come and try and open the bin bags that the butcher's left the bones in. Most of the time we were sort of beleaguered. Are the dogs there? No, you can come out. And that was a tough time for me and my sisters. My sisters were going through their exams. So Jane was 16. And the last thing she needed was to be moving and adapting to a new way of life. And that showed in her exams. I was younger. And then we moved back into our old house when my dad moved out. They come back to some kind of financial arrangement. And then we lived there. Then my mum met a last husband, Dave, who I was very lucky that she met him, I said earlier. And the reason for that was because I was sort of starting to go off the rails. I was...
What sort of stuff were you?
Well, I was hanging out at night. My mum certainly didn't have the time and energy to look after all of us and go through her divorce. And I used that opportunity I used that freedom to mix with another crowd, climb on the school gates, climb over onto the roofs, smash windows, go onto the railways, burn down huts, that kind of stuff.
Burn down huts?
Yeah, well I didn't mean to burn down the hut. I meant to burn down the school, but the wind changed and the hut got it. So I...
When Dave came into the picture, though, that the burning down of huts stopped.
All stopped. He provided some stability. Most of all, he's provided financial stability. And so instead of me thinking at 12 or 13 that my natural course of my life would be to go and get an apprenticeship or become a baker or become an electrician or become somebody's a fitter's mate, and then for the main purpose to provide income for my mother, we used to call it keep. You have to pay your keep. And it was that my sisters paid £10 and my sister Jackie had a Saturday job. And we all had to, I had a paper round. We all had to give my mum money, right? Even from the age of 13 onwards. And so when Dave came along, I didn't have to do that. So suddenly I could think a little bit more ambitiously. So I was always quite clever at school, certainly relative to everybody else. It wasn't a high bar. And I managed to get my O-levels, and then I managed to get my A-levels, and then I became the first boy at that school to go to university.
Wow.
And that was purely because Dave said, we can pay for you. So no one in my family had ever gone to university. So suddenly I'm studying chemical engineering at Birmingham University when things could have been so different.
I think when you were still a teenager or even younger, your mum did consider a big change to your life, consideration. What was she thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was 10, when we moved to that flat above the butcher's, my mother brought home some pamphlets about Australia. And these pamphlets were, there was the single parent migrant opportunity. And we were dazzled by these sort of leaflets, A5 leaflets, and that showed this beautiful Australia, Sydney Opera House and kangaroos and the money with platypuses on the back of it. But they still had the Queen's head. So it was still comforting. It wasn't too far. It was comforting, but exotic. And so we were planning to leave, me, my sisters and my mother, 1974. Mum went through the whole process, went through the interviews. She got us all on side. We were ready. We thought we might get a koala handed to us at the airport. And then my mum said, "We're not going." And we're all scratching our heads going, well, I thought it sounds great. Why aren't we going? And I've talked to my mum about this since, and she said, well, there's a clause in the contract, this assisted passage contract, that says if the Australian government deems that she, my mother, is not financially or cannot prove that she's financially independent of the state within 6 months of her arriving, and by the way, the Australian government, they provide the parameters of that, and it's non-negotiable, then she would have to hand the children over into care.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is this true?
That's
Jeff?
True. That was true for her.
Wow.
And she said, I just could not sign that document that said she said anything could have gone wrong. I could have broke my leg. I could have fallen ill. I could have lost my job. Anything that meant that, you know, in 6 months' time, there was some scintilla of reason for the government to say, you failed the test. I'm afraid the children have to come to us. And then we would have been, you know, farmed out to Outback Farms or wherever it would have been. And she went, the risk was too great, so we're not going.
Well, that's the kind of ultimate argument to always read the fine print in anything you sign.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, when I saw Kevin Rudd apologise, I think it was to 500,000 brutalised children, they became the forgotten Australians that went through that same system. I remember saying to my mum, gosh, that was a lucky escape.
Now, Jeff, we're going to change key slightly. I'm going to play something for you, and I'm going to get you to explain to me what this evokes. Let's listen.
The time in Britain and Germany is 12 noon. In Australia, it's 9 p.m. In the Far East, it's 6:30 p.m. In Canada, it's 7 a.m. And in New Zealand, it's 11 p.m. Time once again for worldwide family favourites.
Tell me, why are we hearing that stirring piece of music, Jeff Green? What's that all about?
That is Two Way Family Favourites, which is a UK BBC Two, BBC Radio 2 show that used to be played at 12 o'clock on a Sunday lunchtime. It started out in 1945. I think it was originally a forces radio show that connected the British forces in Germany and Gibraltar and Hong Kong to their families back home. It then morphed over the years to include the Empire, or the old Empire, the Commonwealth. And
I think that's what we call it now, not the Empire.
Well, sorry.
Update. On that terminology.
We still call it the Empire. I think Prince Philip calls it the Empire.
I think he certainly does.
So then it became, as I said, this connection between Australia and New Zealand, and that 1,000,010 pound POMS that came over between the 45 and I think 82. That's when it ended, and the people that they left back home. So obviously before emails and before Skype and before, you know, all these things.
Well, even phone calls,
phone
I guess,
calls, exactly,
expensive, you know, and tricky to arrange in this period.
Absolutely. It would, yeah. I mean, maybe £9 for a minute if you could get it and had to be connected via Singapore and then down the line and Darwin. So these people used to write these little postcards and they would request songs. And I would be listening at age, you know, 10 or 11 with my mum cooking dinner and the smell of, you know, burnt chicken and with the giblets still inside that hadn't been taken out of the plastic bag. My mum's a wonderful cook. There were moments. And we would listen to these stories. And what struck me was were these people who were talking. They were young women, usually. And they were sending messages to mum back home saying, hey, we've arrived in Waiala and we're looking forward to seeing you in 3 years' time. And the little one sends their love. And Elizabeth is not what we were imagining, but you know, please play Green Green Grass of Home by Tom Jones to us. And I was and there were people from Mandurah and people from, you know, Ipswich and Yakandanda and all these really interesting and exotic sounding places that I'd never heard of and would never ever imagine I would ever visit. I just imagined bleached, really bleached white sunshine and this maybe this idyllic scene, but at the very heart of it was homesickness for the people back in England and Wales and Scotland and Ireland that they weren't seeing and they weren't likely to see, but they were in search of a new life. I actually meet some of those people now. Sometimes with my job, I do shows on cruise ships, and which has now got a very quite often an elderly clientele. And I'll still hear these northern accents with these little old ladies with dandelion fluff for hair, and I'm like, are you? And they went, I'm Australian. I haven't been back to England for 55 years. And I have no wish to. And I went, but you must have been the 10-pound poms. Yeah, we are. You were those young women in pinafores that I was listening to. And now, of course, they're elderly and, you know, they're grandmothers. And, you know, it's interesting to see them they all come full circle with their own grandchildren.
And it's kind of interesting that you and your mum and your sisters could get that flavour of homesickness before you'd even left really a council flat in Chester. You got a sense of that emotion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was the tyranny of distance and the fact that they wouldn't see them. They wouldn't see these people that they were writing to. I didn't know who these people were, but I knew that they were desperate to stay in touch.
So your mum didn't emigrate under the fear that your children would be snatched from her, and you stayed up at home, stays at school, and the first kid from your school to go on to university. What did you study?
I studied engineering. It was originally mineral engineering and became chemical engineering.
Well, why on earth am I not talking to Jeff Green, the highly regarded chemical engineer, instead of Jeff Green, the comic?
Oh, yeah, you might have done. You might have been on Mount Isa Radio and I would be working in the mine there and, you know,
probably
maybe
a lot better off.
Looking forward to my pension.
That's right.
It's going to be just around the corner. But like some fool, I was very lucky. I left university. I went to work for a company called BOC, selling oxygen and acetylene to welders. That was my first job. Obviously, I got fed up of the glamour of that and wanted to, you know, find some alternative course of my life. I was really unhappy in that job. I'd always been good at maths, physics, chemistry, like a lot of, you know, kids, boys, you know, when we're gender profiling, that's what boys did. You know, actually, when I got to university, I realised I really enjoyed laying about, sleeping in and getting drunk. But
that's also boy behaviour in certain
college
categories.
Exactly. I got my 2-1. I got a great degree, went to BOC, part of their graduate training scheme. Hated it. Hated being around this industry. Felt it was very restrictive. I didn't like the rules. I didn't like anything about being employed by someone else.
Were you still living in Chester?
No, I was living in a place called Guildford, just outside London. And then I got dumped by a girl. And the girl I was engaged to at university, a girl called Mandy, dumped me, which at the time I thought was the most painful thing that was ever going to happen to me. My friend, Nazir Afzal, who is now a big cheese in the Crown Prosecution Service I was at uni with, he said, Jeff, I'll cheer you up. We'll go to this new place I've heard about called the Comedy Store in Leicester Square. Now, the Comedy Store was the mecca of stand-up comedy in those days. Ben Elton was playing there, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Robin Williams would drop in. The young ones were playing. It was just, there was a queue around the block, and we got tickets to see the Late Show Friday midnight. The show didn't end till 2 o'clock in the morning. I was 23. I couldn't believe this world existed, and I loved it. I go along. I see these three great comedians, and they're dressed like me. They're my age. They're not in spangly suits. They're not telling hack jokes. They're telling stories about their lives, stuff I can relate to. And I'm thinking, this is wonderful. How would you ever get to do something like that? And as I'm leaving, I see on the door of the Comedy Store an A4 piece of paper with the Comedy Store letterhead on it. And it said, open spots, interested acts. If you want to try out for 5 minutes at the Comedy Store, contact this number and we will give you a booking. And the butterflies erupted in my stomach. And I was like, this is how you do it. This is the path. This is how they did it, those boys on stage I've just seen. So I took the number down and I talked to Naz about it. And off I went. And every time I looked at it, I got terrified. I went, you can't do that. That's not something you can do. You're not allowed. It's other people do those exciting things. You're an engineer. After a few weeks, I started to get the nerve up. Nazir said to me, "Jeff, there's a place called Jackson's Lane Cabaret Workshop I've read about. It's in Highgate in North London. Tuesday night, £5. Go there. Comedians talk to hopefuls about what the circuit's like." So I went as a halfway house. I went along to that.
And what
there's
did
two
you learn?
Of us still there, who's still doing comedy from those 32 years ago. Me and Eddie Izzard.
Get out.
And we're the only two from that little group.
What was he like back then?
He was weird. Quirky, just out of Sheffield University. I had a very long coat on and spoke funny, but lovely. Wasn't quite as... His genius had not shown itself at that point. He was just odd. But I liked him. And he liked me. I ended up lending him...
He may say the same about you, Jeff.
I lent him £1,000 to start his first comedy club up. And he paid me back £50 a month. And I went... Eddie, that's going to take like forever.
You should have really just asked to get royalties, I think, on that investment. In Eddie's art. What did you learn from that, as you call it, halfway house before you launched into comedy yourself?
Not really anything. I learned how to get gigs, how to be persistent. I learned what kind of gigs there were around. There's only half a dozen in London. There's comedy scene in the UK is enormous now, but there was half a dozen. It was just a cottage industry. It was rooms above pubs. It was places, little vegetarian cafes would just move the chairs from a corner, and you would stand in the corner with no microphone and just perform. You'd be followed by a juggler and then a clown that would stick a firework up his backside and light. It was very, very bohemian and avant-garde, and I loved every minute of it. And it was so different to engineering.
What about the hecklers? Could they sometimes be as good as the comedians?
Hecklers were amazing. One of the reasons I talk quick is because it's a response and a defence to heckling. I found if I just delivered lots and lots of jokes as fast as possible, they would be daunted by the onslaught. And I mean, that's kept me in good stead. I enjoy performing to that, but that was the reason. There was no dawdling. There was no mulling over and contemplating your punchline. No shaggy dog stories. It was jokes, jokes, jokes to keep the hecklers off. I mean, people would, guy walked on with a guitar, and he had a blow up strawberry, and he starts playing the guitar, and someone says, "What are you doing with that stupid prop?" And he says, "Oh, well, it's just part of the act." He went, "I was talking to the strawberry."
But still, that first moment where you go from thinking, "God, this looks fun and exciting," and actually standing in front of people and trying to make them laugh. Well, how did your first gig go?
The first gig was I had to start to write some jokes, and there's lots of things to learn in stand up, especially when you're an original performer, i.e., you're performing your own material. That, you know, you've got to learn how to write jokes. You've got to learn joke construction. You've got to understand stagecraft, pacing, audience interaction, lights, microphones. You know, it's for somebody that had never stood on stage. I wasn't an actor. I wasn't somebody that had a grounding in amateur dramatics. My first time on stage was my first time on stage, and I wrote it all on my hand. I learnt it by rote, walking around my flat, just saying it over and over and over again. The first thing I learnt was to wait for the applause. Wait for the applause. Wait for the laugh. There was no applause. But wait for the laugh.
Wishful. This is the wishful aspiration of the comic.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's one of the things my wife always complains to me about. She says, "You get applause. People clap you when you turn up for work. It's a real bee in a bonnet." She said, "No one claps me. When I do the dishes, I don't get clapped." I said, "Well, you got clapped when you dropped your dinner in Hungry Jack's. You skidded on a chip. The tray went over your head. They gave you a standing ovation." It's not true. But yes, that is. It's part of a theatrical tradition that you get clapped when you walk out on stage. I think really it's an opportunity to create energy. And because we need energy. A dead room is a dead room, and everyone knows how terrible that is. Clapping just gets everyone going, and so which we will then use that opportunity to start and create a connection. That's the most important thing in comedy, is connecting. Three rules in comedy: connect, connect, connect. And that's your job as a comedian, is you have to attend to that connection between you and the audience at all times, from the beginning, and also try and tell them jokes in the meantime as well.
When that connection doesn't work, though, Jeff, how's that?
When that connection doesn't work, that's when you're dying. And there's usually a good reason for it. There's some reason. And then you have to summon up all your strength, because what you want to do, what your mind tells you, is to speed up, get it over with. This is terrible. This is embarrassing. They're uncomfortable. You're uncomfortable. Please make it all end very quickly. Just knock the jokes out. But you can't do that. You have to work counterintuitively. You have to slow down. You have to let the audience get back on board with what you're saying. Most people in the world are lovely and want you to succeed. There's a few crazies, but most people are desperate to will you on to success. But you've got to let them help you, and you have to slow down. So you're fighting this heart rate that's in the 140s with this need to talk and allow people to connect with you, and you to connect with your own words, and then hopefully at the end, you know, you'll get a few laughs to walk off with some dignity. And when people say, how did it go? You say, it went fine. Then you go home and smash up your flat.
Did that happen to you much when you were
in the early days? Yeah. And you learn way more when you die than you do when you succeed. When I died on stage, I would go home and I'd be up all night rewriting my material, changing the order, working out what went wrong, why did it go wrong, everything. You question everything, and that's vital. I mean, it's the same in any industry. When you fail spectacularly, it really focuses the mind, because it's so horrible that you don't want it to happen again. But and it's part of the apprenticeship. It's like asking an electrician, has he ever lost his eyebrows? Well, of course he has. That's just what happens. People have catastrophic events in the early days.
But then sometimes people change career as a result.
Yeah, that's fine, because, you know, comedy will find you out. It's not for everyone. There's been probably, 10,000 people in the world have done a stand-up comedy gig, but there's only a few hundred that wanted to carry on.
Podcast, broadcast and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jeff, you were describing your early days in the comedy scene in the UK. How tough was it to make that your job, to shift from selling oxygen to plumbers? Is that what you said you did? That sounds impossible when I say that.
I'm sure there
everyone
plumbers
needs
there
oxygen.
Yeah, we all do.
Was it tough to actually make it as a professional?
Look, there's a lot to be said for not realizing quite how hard it would be. In retrospect, it didn't feel that difficult. One of the first things I made sure I did was clear my debts. Debt is so debilitating. It limits all of your options. And I mean, I was very lucky. I came from an era which had, the government paid for your fees, and I actually got a full grant. My parents were poor enough for me to be lucky enough to get paid to go to university. I'm still spending that money. Got so much of it. And so I cleared my post university debts, and I was working at BOC in the morning at 6 a.m. finishing at 5-6 o'clock. Then I would shower and then I would go to a gig, and I'd finish the gig, and then I'd want to hang out with the comedians, because the ones that didn't have jobs were all going to each other's houses after that, and I'd want to go too, not go home and get ready for BOC. And having said that, they were lovely to me. So I cleared my debts, and then I just started to get more work. I then won a competition, which was for swimming, but that's irrelevant. Which was for the Comedy Store New Act of the Year, and in 1989 I beat Eddie in that competition, and a few others who are now household names. Let it go, Jeff. And they sent me to Montreal to learn about comedy over in the States. So the Montreal Comedy Festival's huge. There's three big festivals, really. There's the Melbourne Comedy Festival, Montreal, which is Juste pour Rire, the Just for Laughs festival in June, and then there's the Edinburgh Fringe, which is massive, and they're the three main events in any comedian's calendar if you can get invited to them. They sent me there. I saw all these great comedians. I was still working. I came back, but I was starting to get this kind of apprenticeship. And in 1990, I had enough money to lend friends money if they needed it, but also I thought if it doesn't go well, I can probably last a year on this money, and if I don't eat Tuesdays and Fridays, and so that's what I did.
and
I phoned
swimming.
My mother, and she cried her eyes out.
I was going to say the first kid in the family to go to university.
Yeah, was devastated. She said, I said, Mum, I'm going to be... I mean, she thought all comedians were, you know, drug addicted, alcoholic, you know, but I wasn't. And so I said, Mum, it's honestly something that I love. My mum's always been supportive of me. I mean, actually, I know I'm her favourite. She never said it, but I know it. I can see it in her eyes, and so she was going to support me whatever I did. And of course, you know, as they say, you're only as happy as your least happy child. I think Joan Rivers said that. And so if I was going to be happy, that's all she needed to hear. And then she saw me on Des O'Connor, sat next to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone being the comedy act, and suddenly all those tears were forgotten.
What was the relationship like with the other comedians? I mean, I know that you must enjoy each other's company and it sounds like you were learning from each other, but does it get competitive too? Like, is it a bit bitter when you see Eddie do what Eddie does?
No, not people that genuinely deserve it. And most people that you see are really hardworking, super talented people. It's the best do rise to the top. I mean, we kid ourselves that there's a few, you know, rough diamonds that never made it. But there was probably a good reason for that. But most of the people you see, the Michael McIntyres, the Eddie Izzards, the you know, the Dave Hugheses, the Adam Hills, all of those people apply themselves, work hard, and have something, have a little something that the audience can latch onto.
So you worked hard, Jeff, you know, building up this career in the UK. You're on TV, you're doing the comedy circuit, you're impressing your mum, the fact that you're sitting next to Arnold Schwarzenegger at events. Why relocate to half the world away?
So I wrote three books that became bestsellers in the UK, The Etiquette of Living Together, The Etiquette of Being Single, the tragic follow-up, and The Etiquette of Having a Baby.
I feel like I should ask you what's W in each of them, or what's P, you know, how well do you know
your... off air too. I used to remember them all, but that was 2002, 2005. Hated Having a Baby. They were great. I had a Radio 2 series of my own, The Green Guide to Life, and I had a lovely house in Hampstead and had two lovely children. They were born in the Royal Free Hospital in Camden, but my wife was really unhappy. Fiona was very unhappy at home. When I say home, I mean England. In London, everything looks rosy from the outside, but I knew she was struggling. She was a Melbourne girl, and she didn't have her family with her, and she didn't have her friends with her, and she was having to bring up two little babies that weren't sleeping, and a husband that worked nights and came home worse for wear and was certainly enjoying his life and him being creatively fulfilled, but she wasn't. And I was very aware that something had to give, that we weren't going to last if it stayed like it was.
I was going to say, I guess it's you noting that means that you're the A to Z of being married rather than the A to Z of single dadness, I suppose.
I enjoy being married to Fiona, and I knew that the future lay in Australia at some point. Not at that point. I still had lots of things going on. But then Fiona gets a phone call from Australia that says that her dad's really poorly and that she needs to go home as fast as possible. And I mean that night. So it's, you know, got the phone call at 7 a.m. I was actually away. I was on tour. My friend had to take her and my children to Heathrow Airport, and put them on a flight at midnight, November the 10th. They got home November the 12th, missed a day. She saw her dad. Her dad passed away November the 16th. And I, you know, I got the phone call that told me all that. But really at the bottom of it was, Jeff, I'm not coming back. I can't come back to London. I need to stay here. I need to be with my mum, and this is home for me. And I went, yeah, fine. I'm ready to come. You know, forget my career. Actually, I'll start again. And I really believe that. I'll try. I'll take a chance. Looking back, my goodness, I was doing the craziest thing, because there's only four gigs in Australia, four comedy clubs. I can play them in a weekend, and I was expecting to live here forever. So I packed all the stuff up. Feed came, stayed where she was, and I shipped it all out. And we ended up in a little flat. Lived with her mum for a while in Heidelberg, in right during the bushfires. It was in the Millennium Drought, 2009, the GFC. You know, Julia Gillard was a new prime minister. It was an incredible time, the mining boom, incredible time to relocate. And I just went, I have no choice. And there's a wonderful thing about having no choice. You're back to the wall. I've got to make this work. And I can't go back because, you know, I have to stay here and apply myself to this country.
This brings us to the new show, Letters Home. Tell me about the idea behind this show.
This show, I wanted to, obviously, it's the 10th anniversary of being here. And I've always wanted to, I've always remembered that show, the two-way family favourites, and those letters home explaining how they were getting on. And I read books about people, Scottish ladies that have written letters and they've been published, and the breathlessness and the excitement of this new country, and I've been swimming in Manly, and oh my God, I got burnt by the sun, and oh mother, it's so clean here in Australia, and I love those, and I knew I had that in me, and I knew I needed to talk to my mum about what I'd done here. So I wanted to walk back this past 10 years through letters and some emails and my notes that are in my diary to my mother, explaining how we'd been getting on for these past 10 years. So I decided to create this show that she would receive a letter from me each year, all true. People have said, it's an epistolary memoir. Well, I don't even know what that means. But I said, no, it's a comedy show. But everything, absolutely everything is true chronologically and factually. Well, and so that's what the show is about.
Can you read us some of these? Let's start with the first letter that you wrote, that you write to your mum when you arrive in 2009.
Yeah, so they're written on these aerograms. Remember these? These very thin sort of tissue paper.
They're so lovely. They're such an evocative thing to get in the mail, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure everyone at home's got a stack of them in the attic from granny and aunties from way back. So this is one of my first letters. March 12th, 2009. Mum, well, what a relief to say that we're finally here in sunny Australia. We've been here 10 weeks now, and it seems like only yesterday when we arrived in Melbourne. All of us living in one room in Fiona's mum's house in Heidelberg. Our suitcases stacked up around us, sleeping on a futon, which is Japanese for concrete. We're out of there now, thank God, and we've got a little house near the beach in a place called St Kilda, the jewel of Port Phillip Bay, Melbourne's playground, and the discarded mattress and abandoned underpant capital of Australia. It's weird, but walk through St Kilda streets and you'll never be more than 10 feet away from a pair of dusty old underpants kicked into the gutter. Red pairs, blue pairs, grey pairs, Bonds, Calvin Kleins. I often wonder what catastrophe befell the owners of all these underpants that they felt compelled to continue the rest of their journey commando style, with all the chafing that that entails. It's one of life's mysteries, up there with why we need a pocket in pyjama tops and how it is that people who snore always seem to get to sleep first. That's my first bit of a letter.
It sounds like you're in a little bit of shock there, Jeff, by the extremists of the situation that you'd found yourself in. How tricky was it to live with a mother-in-law and two small children?
That was very difficult. It was very kind of her. We're actually at that point also in a bit of a housing boom. You know, it was very difficult to find rented accommodation, no matter how much you offered. Me and Fiona offered 6 months rent in advance in a house in Warrandyte, and we got turned down. We were considered, no, you just weren't good enough. So, yeah, it was tricky for us to find a place. So we got the my mother-in-law's offer of the place. I remember this creaky bed and the children and all this, and the suitcases and she's one of those elderly ladies that doesn't put the air conditioning on for anybody. May put it on for half an hour on Christmas if it tops 45. So, you know, we would sneak the aircon on when she wasn't looking.
The street signs in Australia is something that you were struck by as well, the road signs.
What
did you reflect to your mum about those?
So here's another part of this first letter. Mum, you asked me for my first impressions now I live here. Well, I probably know the Australians a little better than when I first arrived, especially being married to one. But they'll always be curious to me because despite a shared language, Australians do have funny ways, not just the obvious ones, like answering yeah, nah, yeah, nah, yeah, nah to perfectly straightforward questions or using get lost in a form of warm greeting. For a start, when you live here and own a car, you realise the roads in Australia don't have any signposts to anywhere where you might want to actually visit. That might be the beach, the airport, or, heaven forbid, a gig that pays cash money, but only if you get there on time, Jeff. There's just this ridiculous assumption you've lived here your whole life and know where you're going. Sure, they'll give you signs to the southeastern suburbs, but who's still navigating by compass and sextant in 2009? To be fair, they have named and signed every pissy little creek the road crosses from Melbourne to Cape York, Perth to Port Hedland. Shaughnessy's Creek, Dead Horse Creek, Vincent's Creek, Cement Creek, Blackwater Creek, on and on, perhaps assuming I'm droving 400 head of cattle and trying to get the kids to the playgroup from the CBD. They also invest in signs that give helpful advice, like, don't sleep and drive, as if it's a conscious decision people are making while at the wheel. I just can't imagine anyone's cranking their seat back to grab a 20-minute power nap while saying to their partner, I'm very tired, but I'll keep driving. Just give me a nudge when we reach Adelaide, will you?
Jeff Green, seeing Australia with English eyes in letters that he imagined writing back to his mum in the UK. In this period, Jeff, when you're staying at your mum-in-law's place, what kind of gigs were you getting? You say that, you know, the comedy scene here was so much smaller than the UK. How hard was it to start doing shows?
I got an agent, which was very lucky. I got, who's still my agent now, a guy called Andrew Taylor, and we became very good friends. And that was one of the keys to getting stuff outside of the normal comedy scene. So there was the Comics Lounge in Melbourne, there's the Sit Down Comedy Club in Brisbane, and the Comedy Store in Sydney. So I played all of those, as I said, very quickly. And then I needed to branch out. And I remember getting offered some gigs in East Timor. Although it wasn't told to me as East Timor, it was actually just, will you do some shows for the Australian troops? And of course, being a new permanent resident and eager to play my part in this wonderful country that I was now calling home, I said, yes, of course I will. What's the fee? There's no fee. It says you're doing it for the honour. I said, in England, we get a fee, £10,000 to play for the troops. It's tough work and dangerous. Not here, mate. We'll give you a pair of redback boots. So I got these boots and I went and had a bit of a training session. And then we were flown out to East Timor to perform for these diggers, young diggers. It was a police state in 2009, and the diggers and the Kiwis were the thin khaki line keeping the police and the army from you know, killing each other. Although that shot hadn't been fired for some time. So I said, once I heard that, I said, yes, I'm coming.
Sure,
exactly.
Sign me up.
And they gave me a go in a Black Hawk helicopter. Wonderful. And I was there with a guy called Ian Moss, right, who's from Cold Chisel.
Indeed.
Who everyone would know on sight. I'd never heard of him. I didn't know who he was. I thought he was part of the catering team. I said, what kind of sandwiches are we going to be having at the at this East Timor place? He went, he says, I don't make sandwiches. I said, no, it'll be cold wraps, local products. Is that what you'd be providing? He went, no, Jeff, I'm in.
Moss
from Cold Chisel. I went, oh, well, pleased to meet you. Anyway, he's the headliner, and I've seen him since. He rips me about it.
You know, you mistook Jimmy Barnes for the guy cleaning up the litter.
Yes, I don't even know who that is, but he was lovely and a wonderful acoustic guitarist, and what a great show for the Australian troops. I was, but of course, East Timor is a Catholic country, which I had no idea. Of course, Indonesia is Muslim, but this tiny little speck off the coast of Darwin, half an island, is Timor Leste, is Roman Catholic, all devout, and so when I get to the show, I realise there's all the diggers. Me and Ian are looking at them. They're all there, and then they're in. They've got their camouflage stuff. They've been on patrol, so they've got all this black stuff on their faces. They've got their M16 rifles. Now that's a tough gig, right? That's not heckling. If they don't like the jokes, a little red dot appears on your forehead. But I'm looking at these people, and then I'm looking, well, who are those other people? Nuns. There must have been 20 nuns that had come from the local nunnery and had sat in the show, the comedy show.
Surely they were there to see Ian Moss, those nuns.
I had no idea. Can you imagine where you pitch a show between soldiers and nuns?
That's a really tough audience.
It was. They were lovely. Look, I think they couldn't walk out. There was nothing to walk to.
You survived that, and then I think came back home via Darwin. What happened in the gig up there?
Darwin. Yes, Darwin was interesting. It was the first time that I'd realised that Australia wasn't just a, you know, a different version of England. I actually included it in one of my letters to my mother in June 14th, 2010, if I can read that.
Please do.
I love this country, Mum. Or I did until I stopped in Darwin on the way back and I performed my first ever show there, if you can call it that. Any lingering thoughts I may have had that Australia is just a sunnier version of England, but with palm trees and parrots, has, after my experience in Darwin, been firmly banished. For a start, the climate is the stuff of nightmares. It was 36 degrees and 4,000% humidity. Oh my God, Mother, the sweat. Then the organiser, a bloke called Damo, who seemed to be permanently drunk, said to me, "Jeff, because of the weather, I've decided we're going to do the show outside. But don't worry, I've put some fans near the side of the stage to keep you cool, and I've set the lighting rig up outdoors. You'll be fine." As you know, I'm a trusting soul, so I said, "OK, you're the boss. You know what you're doing." Well, he didn't know what he was doing. As I walked out on stage, he turned the spotlights on, and at that instant, every flying insect from 10 kilometres suddenly descended upon me. They got to those fans and were fired into my face. It was awful. I'm trying to perform at the same time. I'm being peppered with these tropical-sized creepy crawlies, which I'm having to spit out mid-punchline. I swallowed something, Mum. I don't know what it was. A moth, a cicada, a budgie. I do know it's stuck in the back of my throat and I nearly choked to death. People in the audience thought it was part of the act. I heard someone say, "That pommy bird swallowing bloke was funny. What a unique and original show he had."
I'm glad you've survived these extreme experiences that you've had, Jeff. Did your mum come and visit? Has she been out to see you in Australia?
My mum has been out. She at one stage she was going to come, but she had an eye infection and she was a bit nervous about. I think when you get a little bit older, you do struggle to do this journey on your own. And she was going to come on her own. And but she's been out, yeah. And she, of course, you know, the grandchildren are an incredibly powerful lure. So and we dangle them in front of her at every opportunity.
And what about you? What about you going back to the UK? How is it for you when you go home? Do you still think of it as home?
I don't think of it at home. I think Australia as home. I went back to England in 2018 in June, and I was doing the Chester Comedy Festival. So I'm staying at my mum's house and I've got my shirt off because I'm ironing my shirt. Mum says, "I'll iron your shirt." Mum, I'm in my 50s, I can iron my shirt, thanks. So she says, "OK." And she's fussing around me as mums do. And then she went, "Jeff, what's that on your back?" And I went, "What, Mum, what is it?" She went, "Jeff, there's a mole on your back. What is it?" And I went, "I can't see it. What mole?" She went, "Oh, it's a little bigger than the others. Have you had it checked?" I said, "No, I haven't had it checked, but Australia's pretty hot on these things." So she says, "Okay, please check it for me, Jeff." So I go and do the Chester Comedy Festival, and it's great. It's my hometown. I'm the headlining show at the Chester Town Hall, and it's full, and I have a lovely time. And then I go off to Budapest, and I do shows there. And then I think nothing of it, and I come back to Australia, and I write to my mum. "It's lovely. Thank you for looking after me and the kids and Fee and everything." And my mum, the first thing my mum writes back is, "Get that mole checked." So I said, "Yes, I will." So I got back on the Monday and I went to the mole clinic, a dermatologist in Melbourne. And I said, "My mum wants me to look on it. Have a look at this mole, please." So I take my shirt off and he went, "OK, yeah, yeah." He says, "I might just take that off right now." I went, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "Come back in a week and I'll let you know." He says, "You have heard of melanoma, haven't you?" I went, "Yeah, I've heard of melanoma, but I'm English and I've spent most of my life in dark and comedy clubs. I'm hardly in the high risk category." Anyway, I come back and when I went back the next week, he says, "You need to give your mum some flowers." And I went, "Oh, that sounds like a nice way of giving me some bad news." He says, "Yeah, it was melanoma." He says, "It was 0.25 millimetres. We get very nervous when it gets to 1 millimetre. Your mum's just saved your life." He says, "In 18 months, that might not have been quite so operable." So I went, "Oh, okay, thanks." So suddenly I've got this. So he takes 9 centimetres of skin off my back and he sews it up and I call my mum. I thought about not telling her because I didn't want her to worry, but I did tell her. I said, "Hey, here's some flowers," and then tears, more tears. My mother cries a lot. But, even in her 70s, she's still looking out for me.
Oh, Jeff, thank goodness you got that checked out. Did that make you start thinking about your adopted homeland differently?
I think I should be I should be pushed to the front of the citizenship queue. I've performed for the troops. I now know who Ian Moss is, and I've had melanoma. And but you know what? I put it on Facebook, and all my friends went, I've been meaning to have that checked. I went, look, if I can get it, you all can get it. So, you know, and I'm not somebody that is a sun worshipper. So everyone I now see get checked out, even on the cruise ships, I'm going, you fools. Have you felt Dr. Frank's scalpel? It's not fun. My wife used to say to me, Jeff, I'm your ticket to sunshine, when she would get angry with me. And she stopped saying that since the melanoma diagnosis.
Yeah, money back. But what about the sense of ease? You say, you know, when you were back in Chester, how lovely it is. Is there still a part of you that's really only understood in the UK that you, is a bit harder here in Australia? Is there something you miss about your home?
Whenever I go home, I always, when I come back, one of the reasons I don't go very often, apart from the price of the flights, but one of the reasons is I get incredibly homesick when I'm back, and I'm very maudling. And I found the best way to deal with any kind of that homesick is to avoid it. And I really focus on the future. I don't try not to focus on the past when I'm home. But, and I also, the cure for homesickness is cold hard realism, that you're on holiday, it's not raining, you have got to go to work, it's a different environment. You know, all those £10 poms we talked about, those millions that came over, half of them went back, and half of that came back again, and they were in this constant state of flux, and they destroyed themselves financially and matrimonially, because they just weren't sure if they'd have just gone back and had a bit of a holiday and then realized, you know, where their life truly was meant to be, they wouldn't have had so much heartache.
You're now bringing up your kids as Australians, I guess. How do you imagine the kind of childhood they're having compared to the one that you had back in the UK?
I said to my friend, we're ruining them. Our kids are ruined. My kids, you know, they have school fates. They cycle to school through Albert Park. They have a day off during the Grand Prix. You know, they don't know they're born. I really wanted that. When Fiona said, I want the children to be brought up in Australia, I was always for that. There's a thing about Australian feet. You know, Australian feet are wider than the rest of the world's.
What?
The shoemakers know it. And it's because you're bare feet and you wear these. You're looking at me quizzically. There's a thing about having bare feet or thongs or whatever it is that you sit, you're not ensconced in shoes
it
as much.
It somehow feels like a slur to me, Jeff, talking about the wide-footed Australians.
I think it should be a form of celebration. It's barefoot and carefree was what I was always told. I want my children to have wide feet.
Jeff, I'm very happy that we can offer you that in your new country. Thank you for joining us in Australia, and thank you for joining me in conversation.
Thank you.
Jeff Green, and his latest show is Letters Home, in which he reads out some of those letters that he shared with us today and a whole lot more back to his mum in the UK. And he'll be touring that show in Adelaide, in Brisbane, in Melbourne and Sydney. And we'll put all the details up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. And this conversation will be up there shortly too. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.